from WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Snatched from his family in southern Sudan and enslaved from age 7 in the north, Francis Bach survived beatings, thwarted escapes, and 10 years of dehumanization. Now he shares with us his story of contemporary slavery. Tonight, On Point, a modern-day slave narrative, Slave Life, with Francis Bach. But first, we begin in Iraq, where 4 more American soldiers have been killed, 1 in a roadside bombing in Baghdad and 3 in the Shiite city of Karbala. The 3 were members of the 101st Airborne Division and have been identified as Staff Sergeant Joseph Belavia of Wakefield, Massachusetts, Lieutenant Colonel Kim Orlando of Tennessee, and Corporal Sean Gilley of San Bernardino, California. Joel Brinkley is a correspondent for the New York Times in Baghdad. Just hours after he returned from Karbala, I asked him to fill in the picture of what took place there early today.
Last night, just before midnight, a group of American military police working with some Iraqi policemen tried to enforce a curfew on a band of guards for a radical or at least fundamentalist Shiite cleric, and a firefight broke out. 3 American military police were killed, 2 of their Iraqi colleagues, and at least 6 of the cleric's guards. It was the first violent attack between anyone in Karbala and Americans since the war ended. And the Americans went back today looking for this cleric. He had disappeared. There was another brief firefight. No one was hurt in that one. But that is what has occurred.
Joe Brinkley, it sounds like a mess there. This isn't in the Sunni Triangle. This is in Shia territory. We read reports of armored personnel carriers coming back, screaming men and women and children fleeing for cover as the U.S. Forces are firing. It sounds like a mess.
Well, when I was there, and I was there 2-3 hours ago, the town was actually rather calm. People were out in the streets. All the shops were open, people were strolling around, and only in the vicinity of this cleric's office was there any real evidence of violence. And in fact, that seems to be the scene in the South. The Shiites have been relatively friendly and open to the American, but some of their more ambitious clerics, Ayatollah and sheikhs and other hierarchy of that religion, are trying to make a name for themselves by staking out a position against the United States, and they have their own followings. But they seem to be, from what we see, out of step with the Shiite majority in the South.
So you're seeing it as a few and clerics who are arming those around them to make a name for themselves. It was a pretty bloody firefight, though.
It was indeed a rather bloody firefight. It was the first violent outbreak against Americans in the South, and more Americans were killed today than any time in the last month. There was another American killed by a roadside bomb in Baghdad today as well.
And 9 Americans wounded in Mosul in the north, where we read a roadside bomb exploded while a fuel convoy passed by. I guess as of today, the number of Americans killed in combat since May 1st, when President Bush declared an end to major fighting, is past 100. It's 101 now. Joel Brinkley, do you have a sense of whether this kind of trouble is growing or is it gradually receding? What's the overall dynamic?
It has certainly been on the increase in the last month. There have been more bombings and attacks of various sorts, not necessarily against Americans. In fact, most have not been against Americans directly in the last month than there have been in a long time. Americans are harder to hit these days. They're in Baghdad, where most of the attacks occurred. Americans are much better guarded, and a lot of the attacks have been against what people call softer targets, things that are easier to hit, hotels, the UN, a police station, other targets that are not so hard to hit. But the number of attacks has been increasing in recent weeks.
And what are the implications of the Shiite clerical leaders cranking up their rhetoric, and in this case, their armed retinues against Americans?
The military is signaling that they're not going to put up with this a great deal longer. They haven't said what they might do, and the options for them are fairly limited, but they are obviously growing quite upset, and the resolve is obviously growing, particularly after last night, not to allow these clerics to continue mustering anti-American support among their following.
Can U.S. troops clamp down on militant clerics without alienating or turning against them the larger majority Shiite population in Iraq?
That's the quandary. If they were to arrest some of these clerics, it would probably excite and upset a far larger number of Shiites than are involved now. However, if they allow them to sit there and during Friday prayers and at other times continue to foment opposition and even violence, then they have additional trouble. So the military really has a dilemma here.
In the meantime, the curfew goes on in Karbala, is that right? The curfew that these guards, the cleric, were breaking?
The curfew remains. It was imposed only early this week. Karbala did not have a curfew before that because it had been a relatively peaceful town, but the curfew does remain.
Joel Brinkley, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Joel Brinkley is a correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Baghdad. Sudan is a huge country in Northeast Africa, the size of America east of the Mississippi. Since gaining independence from the British in 1956, Sudan has been embroiled in almost continuous civil war between the Arabized Islamic North and the non-Muslim African South. The victims of that war, those killed, displaced, or enslaved, number in the millions. In 1986, a 7-year-old southern Sudanese boy was sent to market on his own for the first time to sell his family's produce. He never came home. Francis Bach is now a man. He joins us tonight to tell of his 10 years of slavery, his escape, and his mission now to free the world's slaves. Can you imagine being scooped up from your ordinary life one bright day and forced directly into long, brutal slavery? Did you think slavery was history? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Francis Bach, author of the new memoir, Escape from Slavery, The True Story of My 10 Years in Captivity and My Journey to Freedom in America. He was abducted into slavery in 1986 and held enslaved for a decade. He escaped in 1996 and in 1999 emigrated to Fargo, North Dakota. Good evening and welcome, Francis Bach.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you for being with us. Also with us in the studio tonight is Randall Kennedy, On Point news analyst and professor at Harvard Law School. Good evening, Randall Kennedy.
Thanks so much.
Great to have you here. Francis Bach, it's an amazing story that you tell in this book. We like to think, I don't know what we wish, that it was a 19th century story or an 18th century story or a story from no century. But here you are, you're just 23 years old, and this was 10 years of your life from 7 to 17. Can you describe your early childhood before all of this happened? Where did you grow up? What were the circumstances? What was your family like?
I grew up in southern Sudan. I was having a happy life with my family when I was a little boy. I remember growing up in a small village called Gurians, and growing up in this big family because my father has a very big family. He has two wives. I have two stepbrothers and two stepsisters, and they have their own house. And my mother had four of us, one of my oldest brother and my two little sisters. And I also heard that my father is the rich person in that village. And I didn't know until when I grew up a little bit.
A rich person, you said?
A rich person. They called it Majak in my native language. And I seen that when I saw people coming to back sometime in about, there's some season the people, really in need a lot of things.
Coming to beg or to ask for food from your family. So it was a farm, and a farm producing what?
Yeah, producing grains and a lot of the things, and we have a lot of animals, two cows. When I say rich, actually, it's a lot of different from in the United States or from other countries.
Rich means something else there.
Yeah, this means something else. This means you have a lot of animals, you have a lot of farms that you consider rich.
You were only 7 when all that came to an end. Do you still have a clear picture in your mind of your mother, your father?
Indeed, I do. I still have that. That's why I survived 10 years. This is what I've been living with this person when I was taken. Keep saying to myself that I want to go back to my family and have the wonderful life with them again.
You describe your father as a magnetic man, 7 feet tall. You're a very tall and handsome man yourself, but he was a real presence in that community.
Yes, he is indeed. He's the man that gave me all the passion that I had and gave me hope, because I used to share with him that when I was very young that, Dad, I want to be like you someday. I want to be called a rich person, and also I want to be able to help my community and help people you know, in my country. So he told me that you will. And he actually called me a special name, calling me the muchacho in my native language, meaning 12 men.
12 men.
12 men.
That is, with the stature, the power, the importance of 12 men.
Yes.
Even though you were only 7.
Yes, even though I was 7, because I share very great ideas with him.
Francis Bach, and then came that unbelievably bad day that would change everything. Your mother sent you to market for the first time to sell hard-boiled eggs and peanuts or beans.
Yes.
She sent a couple of girls along, older girls along with you to keep tabs on you. You were 7. It was your first time. You were proud. Can you describe that day?
I can't imagine how happy am I before my life changed. It was one afternoon. I was playing with some of my friends from the neighbors, and my mother came and she said hi to us and then called me and said, I want to send you to a market. But before you go, I want to warn you that when you go to the market, you're going there to do business that I send you to do, but
don't
not to play
around
with the kids. Don't fool around. And I said to her, yes, quickly, because I really want to go to market. And also, it was very exciting that my mother chose me to go do a favor for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked to one of the girls from the neighborhood, and I have a book that go with Francis and watch him. And I went there. I didn't know that something can happen to me. My life going to change in the next 2 or 3 hours on my way.
So this was a nearby market.
Yes. This is not far. It's a couple miles to work, maybe by 5-6 miles.
So you had your eggs, your beans. You set them up to sell, and you were selling your produce.
Yes. We got there, and I sat underneath. And again, to give people a little bit of background about the market, in Southern Sudan, it's a lot different by going to the big mall here or going to the big grocery store or another stores. People actually gather in a very big, underneath a very big tree, and that's where everybody sell and buy, and
bringing
after they finish,
goods,
yes, after they finish, they go back to their villages. And I was sitting there, you know, underneath the big tree, and beside me, there was a lot of dolls who were sitting there, and I heard some saying that we heard gun shooting, and also I heard some saying that we saw smoke in the point towards
you saw
village.
Smoke in the distance, you heard shooting,
yes,
that
yes.
Tuk-tuk sound.
Yes, and I wasn't aware, and I was very excited to be there until when I looked behind me, seeing all these horsemen and camelsmen and a lot of other working on the foot, carry machine gun, and they started shooting people in the market, that I knew there's something bad.
They were killing people around you.
Yes, I've seen a lot of people being shot, and I've seen a lot of kids who've been grabbed, you know, when they're trying to run.
Adults are running away, men being shot.
And boys and girls and women who've been captured. You know, it was crazy to me to see all this thing happening. And the thing that made me really scared is to see that person, which is not that far from me where I was sitting. A lot of people who've been killed. And in my village, I never witnessed, you know, a dead person before, because when we have some person die, like an old person die, kid are not allowed to see that.
7 years old, and it's the first dead people you've seen, and suddenly before you is a man on horseback.
And then this is the man, a horseman, come, and I stood up and tried to find my way to run, and he grabbed me. He was speaking in a strange language I couldn't understand. He was speaking Arabic, and he grabbed my hand, and then he dragged me and put me with a lot of kids who had already been captured. And after they destroyed everything on the market, we marched all the way to the north.
Francis Bach, we're going to hear a lot more detail from your story tonight. It's a generous thing for you to share it, a terrible, unimaginable thing to have lived through. But Randall Kennedy, Francis Bach is not alone in this. We're reading in the newspaper just this morning of 74, 75 boys in the Nigerian granite quarry chained and breaking rocks. I mean, this is not ancient history.
No, it's not. In fact, human bondage exists today, and it exists all over the world, sometimes in this very country. In the Southwest, there have been instances of bonded labor. Slavery, unfortunately, is still with us. It has been a scourge throughout human history, and it is a scourge that has not been erased.
We'll hear more of Francis Bach's story, but Randall, isn't it amazing to be sitting here with Randall Bach with this story, and here's this vital young man sitting with us now?
It really is pretty extraordinary, and it's especially extraordinary, I think, to be in Massachusetts, because, of course, This is a state that has heard of escaped slaves before.
It had a lot to do with abolition. Hold that thought.
Right.
We're talking tonight about the story of one man's slavery in Africa with Francis Bach, a slave from age 7 to 17. Can you imagine being scooped up at age 7 and made a slave? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the story of one man's slavery in Africa with Francis Bach, a slave from age 7 to 17, and the continuing reality of slavery in the Sudan and beyond. His new memoir is Escape from Slavery. He was enslaved from 1986 to 1996, came to the United States to Fargo, North Dakota, then to Ames, Iowa in 1999. We'll hear about all that tonight. But we want to make this real, and we've just begun to understand the story through the eyes of a 7-year-old, now told to us by a 23-year-old, herded away from the market on the same day, that same morning you'd been with your family, with your mother, with your father, in the bosom of your family. Here you are. And that night, the other children, a number of them, are just crying endlessly. They can't stop, but they are stopped. What happened?
Well, again, to remember this story is bring all my memory back, what I had seen, the life I had before I get captured, and all the kind of thing that I seen on the way. And let me share this story a little bit after the story, everything on the market and mm-hmm. kidnapping women and children. Mm-hmm. On the way to the north, I witnessed 12 years old girl being shot because she was screaming that she seen her mother and father being killed. Mm-hmm. And one of the militia men told her to stop crying, and she couldn't stop crying. And the guy took her out of the group, and he shot her on the head, and that scared me a lot. Mm-hmm. I said, wow, this can happen to me, and mm-hmm. can happen to other kids here. And there was a bunch of us, a lot of kids were sitting there watching these people. They had no idea what was going to happen to them.
Girl's sister then continued
and
crying.
And then that girl's sister was still continuing crying, and the guy had arms off,
With a sword.
With swords. And then he spoke. He said, this is going to happen to everyone if you guys are loud or crying. I didn't hear what he says, but I knew that's what he was trying to tell us. He wanted us to shut up.
And by the next day, you were across that cultural, that political line. You were in northern Sudan. You were at a new home. With a new mother, a new father, their children, but they were not your mother and father, and they did not treat you at all like their child.
Indeed, we, after they done what they done to these two little girls, we were split up to militiamen, and I was given to a guy named Juma Abdullah, which when I first arrived on his farm, he called the whole family to meet me, and his three children were waiting there with the sticks, and they started beating me, and they were shouting, calling a beat, meaning in Arabic word black slave. That was my welcome, and I were very upset. Actually, I started crying when this kid started beating me. Mm-hmm. Until few minutes later, I stopped crying. I said, "Why do I have to cry?" Their mother's watching and father's watching, and the three kids are beating me, and nobody helping me. Mm-hmm. And I said, when I fought with some of my friends sometime, or my little sister,
when you had been at home,
and when I was home, and there's adult who saw it. They came in and separated by fighting.
The adults would intervene and say, stop this. But in this case, they
but
just looked
case,
on.
But in this case, nobody helping me at all. And in fact, they were participating, saying, you know, a beat also. Mm-hmm. And that's made me very upset. Until the kid got tired, they told them to leave. And Juma said to me, come show you where you're going to be sleeping. And he showed me a small shelter that close to the animals. Which I had
a shelter by the livestock pens. They had goats and mainly goats, I guess. And you were eventually made the family goat herd.
Yes. And actually, I even learned that woman, that is why, didn't like me at all. You know, she was speaking the strange language. I couldn't understand that.
The mother didn't like you.
Yeah. She was saying that I don't want to see you here. Don't look at me. If my husband would allow me, I would shoot you. I would rather having the animal than I could have you in my house.
Now, you didn't actually speak. Were they speaking Arabic or some other northern Sudanese language? You didn't speak it when you first arrived.
I knew what she say in the first day after I learned Arabic because she'd been repeating the same word over and over again until I learned Arabic.
But you eventually learned you slept next to the livestock. You were fed incredibly poorly, just slop, whatever was left from the family table, if that.
Indeed, she wouldn't care about me at all. She only, fed me with leftover food, or sometimes she cooked whatever food that she feels she want to give it to me, and I don't have complaint to say, no, I don't need it, and I force myself to eat it because I can't survive without food.
And there's this remarkable moment you describe in the book when you finally, going through all the fear and the confusion of a seven-year-old, you'd finally figured out enough of their language to understand them a bit and finally to address them, and you spoke to your, I guess, owner,
or yes,
the man who owned you one day when he came out, and you said to him his interesting words that a child would choose. The first words you spoke to him in his language, the first question you asked him, a seven-year-old still, I guess, why does no one love me?
Yes.
And why do you make me sleep with the animals? And he went away and didn't answer you for a day, and then he came back with an answer.
Yes, when I asked him this question, actually, I said to myself when they started treating me that way, I said I had to learn this person's language so I can ask him this three questions that stuck in my mind, why they treat me the way they do. And this question I asked them when I learned Arabic, I wasn't very good in Arabic. When I asked him mm-hmm. one afternoon when he came to me, why you called me Abid, black slave,
mm-hmm.
and why you forced me to sleep with the animals,
mm-hmm.
and why nobody loved me. And his answer in that moment was beating. He beat me, and he warned me that if you ask me this question again, I would kill you.
He was shocked that you spoke in his language. You said it was though one of his goats suddenly spoke to him.
Yes, and then 2 days later, I guess, this question hurt him. He came back and he said to me, did you know why we call you Abid, black slave, and why we force you to sleep with the animals? Because you are an animal. That's his answer after 2 days. And I was very upset to hear that because I never heard, growing up with my family, no one never told me you are an animal.
Been loved, and now you were nothing. You were not human in their eyes.
Yes, and also I know I'm not an animal. I'm a human being.
Of course.
I can communicate with him,
mm-hmm.
and he can talk to the animals. So I was very upset, and that's where I began living double life with this person.
Randall Kennedy, there's much more to this story, but it struck me that at that moment, Francis Bach was faced with the kind of dynamic of slavery, that the dehumanization that says, yeah, you'll live with the animals. You are an animal. You are the other thing. We don't take human responsibility for you, even though we own you.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story. It would be traumatic for anyone, but it's even more extraordinary if you think about a child who has been moved from a loving environment and immediately put in an environment where he is undergoing such terrible mistreatment. I mean, it's an absolutely extraordinary story.
It really is. I want to invite our callers into this conversation, and Francis Bach, will hear much more from you. But Siddiqui's calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
Let me just say that, as a black man, that I can, in some respects, relate to the pain that he's suffering, and I feel bad in that regard, knowing the fact that my ancestors, in fact, suffered for slavery for 100 years. But let me just say this, that there's a bigger picture here.
Yes, there is.
Number one, when we talk about slavery here in this country, it was government-sanctioned. I think there's two important points right here. Number one is that the brother, first of all, hasn't explained how he got to this country. And number two, that there's a gentleman, I can't remember his last name, Charles something, Somerville, that allegedly has this group that has been doing rescues over in Somerville. But the bottom line is that in terms of what's going on in Sudan, I think the brother will agree to the fact, because I, in fact, spoke to some Sudanese, that, quote-unquote, the civil war has been going on for several years. Prior to that, there was no issue of slavery. So what I'm saying is that when you have a civil war, there are casualties on both sides. And unfortunately, I'm willing to bet on both sides there are brothers and sisters who suffered the same conditions that he did.
Siddiqui, I've got to ask you, are you trying in some degree to excuse slavery, 10 years of slavery in the context of war?
What I'm saying is that if this country had a tradition of slavery, government sanctioned, what I'm saying is if there had been a tradition of slavery in Sudan, I would say it's slavery. I'm saying it's about terminology. This is not about semantics. And the reason why I'm saying this is because what has happened is that this individual in Somerville, let me just say this, that even some of the so-called rescues, it's been proven that some of them were staged, that people were being paid to be rescued as a propaganda issue. Now, when I say propaganda, the reason why I say that is because what's happening is that What it does, it perpetuates that myth that Africans, in fact, were as much involved in the slave trade as white people. So we were just as guilty, and that this is proof that there's a tradition of slavery which works against our campaign for reparations here in this country.
So, Dickie, we've got your point. I want to put it up against the story of the man sitting with me here who seems entirely credible, but we'll press on that. I guess we need to also put it up against the headlines from today's newspaper about 74, 75 boys in Nigeria pulled out of a granite quarry. A dozen or more had died within recent weeks. They were whipped, beaten. They'd been there for a long, long time. 10-year-olds being forced to break rocks all day. And that sounds like slavery, but let us pick this up. I guess the first question, Francis Buck, in your mind then, or looking back now, were you a slave or were you a prisoner of war?
I was a slave. I was in slavery. I wasn't a prisoner of war. Those who are prisoner of war, they are those who are still struggling, and those who are just start coming from Sudan, from Kenya, called Lost Boys. Mm-hmm. This is the people in struggling, and these are people in face this war. But I was enslaved.
Now, a caller is correct. There is a big context here. Sudan has been in civil war for a long time. It was kind of an artificial creation of the British after they defeated the Ottoman Empire, another one of those. They made the Republic of Sudan. There was a Muslim north, there was a Dinka and widely Christian south where you were living.
Yes.
And it was split. The trouble started when, revived when oil was found in the south and the north wanted it. And a big new round of civil war took off. I guess you were part of of that.
Yes. It's just sometimes difficult, especially for for the people who live this country, because sometimes they hear about Sudan, or sometimes they have a little information, like this brother is calling. I thought he was going to explain. He was coming very well, and now he's trying to make it complicated to me a little bit, saying that I wasn't a prisoner of the war. I now war being going on in my country for a decade now, 20 years old, who killed 2 million people. Maybe he heard about that, and there is slavery in Sudan. There's something happening like every day. The government knows there's militia who go to the south to kill the men and kidnapping women and children and steal the cows and goats and bring them to the north. You know, and there is a big conflict between us here because, as you mentioned, that there is a difference between people. The south were black Christians and enemies, and not only Dinka people living there, mm-hmm. where my tribe, they are, of course, they are Dinka. The largest country, mm-hmm. largest tribe in southern Sudan. And there's a lot of other tribes who are suffering, facing the same issue in southern Sudan. And the problem is, what I know, the government in Khartoum trying to impose Islamic law to everyone.
The northern government wants to impose Islamic law
yes.
on the south.
Yes, they want to convert Islamic to everyone so Sudan become Islamic country. And we, the people in the south, don't want to be Islamic, or we don't want to be Arabized. We don't want to change our custom, you know. Because we believe in our way of life, and we are proud to be Southerner and be African, you know, and we want to perform our tradition rather than being Arabs and being Muslims. Mm. So when there is also, as you mentioned, there is economic conflict because we have oil underneath us in southern Sudan, which government trying to
the government
steal
in the north in Khartoum.
The north in Khartoum trying to steal that away from us.
Would like to have, and out of all that, you got 10 years of what certainly in your detailed telling looks and sounds like slavery. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Francis Buck, in October, a year ago, you sat in the White House with President Bush.
Yep.
After he had signed into law the Sudan Peace Act. It was a bill that formally condemned the Sudanese government for the use of slavery as a weapon of genocide. It's a long way from your, goat herd days to sitting next to President Bush. You want to understand, and our caller asks about this as well, how you got from point A to point, Z there. There were several escape attempts that you made. Take us through those first. As you grew older, I presume, not at age 7, I guess.
Yes, when I learned this family did not going to change, or they're not going to treat me, or they're not going to allow me to be equally with them, or play with this kid, or do what I want to do, rather they force me to do what they want me to do, I said to myself, I have to struggle to get away from these people. So I waited until when I was 14 years old, seven mm-hmm. years working with them, I first decided to escape. Mm-hmm. And I failed the first attempt, and he beat me up, my master, and he said to me, if you escape again, I would shoot you.
Kill you.
In my heart, I didn't give up. I said I'd rather die than be slave. So I wait for 2 days, and then I escape again 2 days after the first attempt, and again I get caught. And he beat me up, and he said, if you try it again, I'm going to kill you next time. And I realized that I had to wait. I didn't have to rush. I have to wait for several more years. And I waited for 3 more years until when I was 17 that I finally decided that I don't care what's going to happen to me.
Hold the story of that escape. I want to turn to Randall Kennedy again for a minute. This brings up all kinds of history and images to mind, Randall Kennedy. No American can fail to hear in this the echo of American history. Our caller says, well, maybe this is a way of diminishing American history or sharing the blame. I guess it's a matter of perspective, but certainly this is a story that has to resonate in this country.
One would think that it would resonate. I think of the 1830s and Frederick Douglass journeying from slavery in Maryland and coming to settle in Massachusetts, along with other people who were fleeing slavery. Some of the most distinguished African Americans in our history were people who were fugitives from slavery. So this is a story that should definitely resonate with all Americans, and it's a great thing that we are hearing about one person's escape, one person's unwillingness to knuckle under to this sort of tyranny. It's also worth noting that, as has been emphasized before, bondage, human bondage, is with us around the world.
With us right now around the world, in many places, and as you said earlier, Randall, not only in Africa. Francis Bach, during those long years of slavery, did the family that you lived with, I'm just curious about, you have this intimate knowledge of this dynamic, did they finally ever come to treat you as a quasi family member? You would think that human sentiment would kick in at some point.
To be honest, and be honest for the listener listening now on this show, they never ever appreciate what I do for them. They never ever welcome me into the family so I can laugh, cheer with them, whatever I could share with them.
You can't laugh with them. You certainly...
And I would tell you this, wish I shared a little bit sometime. I never shook my master's wife.
You never spoke with her?
I never spoke with her. I never shook his hand.
Never touched her, shook her hand, anything in 10
never,
years?
Never, never.
This was weirdly, the mother figure in your world.
Yes.
She was the only mother around.
Yes, and I know also she always told me that don't look at me when she's... going by me, passing by me, saying that don't look at me, you know, and I was very shocked, you know, to say what is such horrible people in the world like this family treating me.
Francis Bach, Randall Kennedy, stand by. We're talking tonight about the story of one man's slavery in Africa with Francis Bach, a slave from age 7 to 17. His new memoir is Escape from Slavery. You can join the conversation. Black Americans, how does this story resonate for you? Does it resonate? And white Americans, how does this story fit into your understanding, your narrative of slavery? How does it resonate for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the story of one man's slavery in Africa with Francis Bach, a slave from age 7 to 17, and the continuing reality of slavery in the Sudan and beyond. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Can you even imagine having walked in the shoes of Francis Bach? Ali is calling from Boston. Ali, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question to ask Francis, but before that, I just wanted to add something. Francis, I think you're actually... in a sadly way, I have to say, I'm glad that they never paid attention to you the way you wanted to be paid attention. This at least motivated you to move away from these animals themselves. And that's one point I wanted to say.
And still, it's a heavy price to pay from age 7 to 17, isn't it, Ali?
Yes, it's a very tough price to pay. But, you know, they actually, they were very stupid. If they were smarter, unfortunately, in an evil way, they would have just given him always hope, and the fact that they never gave him the hope thank God, made him finally decide and get up and
run. Interesting observation. And your larger observation, Ali.
And my question is, my question goes about the Islam and the religion of the North and the South. The Prophet Muhammad, in 1,300 years ago, made slavery illegal. In fact, in Islam, I think it was an African who he freed first and used him as his spokesman to send a message across his tribe and the rest of the community that slavery is a non-starter issue.
But, of course, people in many religions don't necessarily live by their book, by the book.
True. My point goes back, exactly that's what I wanted to ask. First of all, were they definitely Muslim? I wanted to find out. And what kind of Muslim are they in the North that they don't even listen to their own prophet?
Are you Muslim, Ali?
I'm atheist.
Okay.
It's a funny name, you know, atheist.
Yeah. No, we obviously got it, and we got the question, and thanks for the call. Francis Bach, well, I guess, as you describe in the book, they were Muslim. In fact, they insisted that you become Muslim, too. You were given a Muslim name.
Right, I am. Well, I want to thank you, Ali. I wish I can be appended here so I can explain more about the issue of Sudan, and especially give you more information about Islam. I really don't know, but I know the Islam that we have in my country, that's the northern has, is Islam that they think is better off to use any kind of thing or to impose that Islam law to everyone and make it as the key of everything. And I really can't describe it very well, because the way I see it is different. When I explain to my audience sometime, I say this is not a matter of left and right. It's a matter of right and wrong. So basically, the reason I don't explain all about Islam is I didn't study about it. I didn't read the Quran. I don't know what the Quran says. You know, I don't know what kind of law Muhammad, you know, told these people to be performed to everyone's. So basically, this is the horrible jihad, you know, who have all these horrible ideas trying to convert all this idea on us.
Horrible jihad, you're saying?
Yes.
So, but, and you don't know what branch of Islam
I don't
your
know,
was.
And I really don't want to know. You know, I right. really knew from this family, and I knew from perspective of the government that we had in my country.
And they gave you the Islamic name Abdul Rahman.
Yeah, yeah, and this it doesn't mean anything. Even I accept, I said yes, you know, I'm a Muslim, I still consider it, you know, a southerner, I still treat it less than them.
But you're right, just after being given that name, you heard what you were actually being called by them was a different word entirely,
yes.
A word that means maggot.
Exactly. Dude, I mean, it's maggot, whatever it is.
Francis Bach, how did you ultimately escape and end up in the United States? It's a long story, but give us the short version.
Yeah, the short version is when I decided the last time when I was 17, which is the final attempt, I was lucky to make my way to another town where somebody who's an Arab and he's a Muslim too, like I just mentioned earlier now, that it's not a matter of left and right, it's a matter of right and wrong. There is a good Muslim, there is a bad Muslim, and that's happened.
A Muslim man took you in and protected you and helped you with your escape.
Yes, I was very worried when I told him my story that I need help. And he accepted to help me, and he eventually helped me to get to the capital city of Sudan.
So you were at Khartoum, you ended up in a refugee camp for Dinka people there, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, so Dinka people and non-Dinka. It was a refugee camp that filled with all Southerners, and I made my way to Egypt by help of Southern Sudanese who live in that refugee camp.
Now, who exactly helped you get to Egypt?
That's the guy who I stayed with. His name is Garang. He's a Dinka tribe, and he's the one, the main person who really worked hard, who trying to collect some money from some other Dinka who helped me out to finish my process in black market, and eventually I made it to Egypt.
Was Egypt welcoming refugees from the Sudan, or did you have to sneak into Egypt?
I think you don't have to sneak into welcoming them, because a lot of Southerners goes there every week and every month. They have about 1,000 of them goes
you
there.
You studied some English in Cairo. and ended up in Fargo, North Dakota. How did that happen exactly?
Well, I went to Cairo, and I went to the UN. I told my story. I get accepted as a migrant. And
as a legitimate refugee?
Yes, and refugees, yes. And I waited for my studies until my name came. I was sometime in August of 1999, and I was sold to Fargo, North Dakota.
You were sponsored by Lutheran Social Services and a gentleman there named Barry Nelson.
Barry Nelson from Lutheran Social Services in Fargo, North Dakota, which I didn't like this state, actually, when I first came to this country.
A little bit cold there in the winter.
Not a little bit. It's very, very cold. Yeah. Very, very cold. And I didn't like the city. And I was also isolated because the people around me, the people don't speak the language that I speak. And I was stuck. When I first come here, I don't speak English. So
they were kind to bring you, but you eventually moved on from there to Ames, Iowa, where
yes.
there were other Sudanese people?
Yes, indeed. I decided to move to Ames, Iowa, where I stay with the family that I know from Egypt. And then they helped me get a job and work in two jobs until their wonderful organization that I work with them today called the American Anti-Slavery Group, based in Boston here, discovered me. And they asked me to move to Boston, and I decided to move to Boston in 2000 to become this part of abolitionist group.
And so now you tell your story and tell it widely, and it's an incredible story. Do you have any idea how many slaves are left behind in the Sudan today, Francis?
According to my mind, what I know, because in the area that I were enslaved, I couldn't see a lot of slaves every day.
You could or could not? You did see many?
I seen many of them. Mm-hmm. And I know all these men I saw last time when I still there are still working now. They are still with these people. So we're talking about, 100,000 of them still? Who knows? I can't imagine, because I heard everywhere, all this area, the Dalek area, not in the capital city, has slaves.
Plenty. Yeah. Randall Kennedy, whose responsibility is this? In the United States, you refer to the Civil War, pre-Civil War era, abolitionists stood up, and eventually slaves were freed. That was within one nation. Here we have a kind of global conversation going on. Francis Bach is sitting here in the United States.
Yes, this is a global story, and I think it's a global responsibility. That was true in the 19th century, after all. There were many Europeans, particularly people in England, who took a great interest in the problem of slavery in the United States. I think that every run around the world has a stake in this and should raise their voices and do anything that is within their power to do to attack the problem of human bondage.
Francis Bach, we've just got a minute left. What would you like people to do, Americans to do? What can be done?
Well, what I would like to see American people do, or the world do, is to realize that slavery is not thing in the past, because many of us believe that slavery ended over 200 years ago in 1865, and slavery is still alive. So I want them to empower themselves, to learn about these things, that slavery is still alive even in our neighborhood, to speak to those who are still slaves. There is 27 million people slaves worldwide. Not only in my country, these people have been slaves.
Do you still dream of that time? Do you wake up sometimes and wonder?
Indeed. I had dreamed that I used to lie awake at night when I was still with Juma, my master, waiting for someone to come and free me. And nobody come. And there's a lot of kids in my country who lie awake at night wondering who's going to come and free them.
Francis Bach, thanks for being here tonight.
You're very welcome.
Francis Bach's memoir is Escape from Slavery. And Randall Kennedy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org in a moment. Remembering Mother Teresa as we approach her beatification this Sunday. This is On Point. When former CNN photojournalist Linda Schaefer first approached Mother Teresa in 1995 about documenting her missionary work in Calcutta, she was met with a resounding round of no's, but Schaefer persisted until the famous humanitarian, Mother Teresa, acquiesced, inviting her to come and see what her work was about. "Show the real world in which I live and work," she said. "Not too many photographs of me." Mother Teresa died in 1997. This Sunday, Mother Teresa will be beatified in Rome, a major step toward canonization and sainthood. On Point spoke with Linda Schaefer, the last professional photographer to be granted full access to Mother Teresa before her death, from Vatican City earlier today, about the life and legacy of the Nobel Prize-winning nun.
Mother Teresa said to me from the start, don't focus on me, focus on the work. So there weren't that many opportunities that I actually photographed her. But by photographing the work in the orphanages, in the home for the dying, the lepers, I saw her. And what did she always say? She said she saw Jesus in everyone. Therefore, it was really clear that in all the faces of all the patients and the volunteers and the sisters was also the reflection of the love that Mother Teresa showed to everyone. And so I saw Mother Teresa as the greatest missionary of them all. And I also saw her as this incredible mother figure, a figure that would become so important in this coming century, where violence and the old way of doing things didn't seem to work anymore, but her way did work. Photographing and covering the subject matter relating to Mother Teresa in Calcutta and the work of the Missionaries of Charity was not difficult for me. What I did think would be difficult was after I'd been working in the orphanage for a while, which actually petrified me in the beginning because I'd never changed a diaper, but was pretty easy after a while, was when Mother Teresa stopped me in the hallway one day and she said, "Stop taking so many pictures. Go work at the Home for the Dying now." And at that point, I was like, oh, no, because my husband had died of cancer 3 years before, and I didn't want to go back into that place of sadness and grief. But when I went into through the doors of the Home for the Dying in Calcutta, Kaligat, I found nothing but love there from the sisters, from the volunteers, and from the patients themselves. And what I found was an enormous healing experience by entering that world again. And so Mother Teresa once again saved me from my own grief. Mother Teresa believed very strongly that we are all innately saints, but it was up to God when that time would come to actually make us a saint. So sure, her time had arrived. She said it was God's grace when that moment would happen. And so she would say that, if it's God's will that this little pencil be made a saint, then it's God's will. Lasting memory for me of Mother Teresa was when I came back to Atlanta, Georgia, I was with child. The thing I wanted most in the world was to have a child. I conceived my child with my second husband at Christmas in India, and I was able to get a final blessing from Mother Teresa. She placed her hand over my head when I told her I would be going home. And I felt this enormous compassion and light traveling through my body and blessing my child. And I had a dream, and in the dream, Mother Teresa was holding my baby in her arms. And I knew that she would be in my life forever.
Linda Schaefer spoke with us from Vatican City. She's there for Mother Teresa's beatification this Sunday. Her new book is Come and See, a Photojournalist's Journey into the World of Mother Teresa. To view a gallery of Linda Schaefer's photographs, go to our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.